Welcome, everybody, to the Diecast Movie Podcast. For this episode, we have a special interview brought to you by my dad. Take it away, Dad.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Diecast Movie Podcast, where we do movie discussions where the genre of the movie is decided by the roll of a die, and we do interviews, too. And today, we're going to be doing an interview with Frank Farrell. Frank and I recorded this episode at the beginning of October, and due to various circumstances, mostly health-related, this episode is coming out in November, so we refer to Halloween and that kind of stuff. So I apologize for it being a couple weeks later than I was anticipating, but I hope you still enjoy it. And without further ado, let's get to the interview. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Diecast Movie Podcast. And today I'm going to be doing an interview with the writer-producer of Spookies, the producer of Street Trash, and a zombie from the original Dawn of the Dead, the one and only Frank Farrell. How are you doing today, Frank?
Hey there, Steve. Good to see you. Good to meet you, in fact. And thanks so much for having me on.
I'm so glad to have you on the show. And it is through Brendan Faulkner's interview, which listeners can go back to earlier in the podcast episodes and find out that I'm watching Spookies, that I found that about you. And then you and I reached out to each other with this wonderful thing with the internet, Facebook, and all that other stuff where we can just, you know, you find people and communicate, and we finally got it scheduled where we can do the interview where it fits our schedules. And today, here we are on a beautiful October day.
I do a reasonable number of podcasts and interviews, and I try to be hospitable to everyone that I can. I'm always willing to talk. You know, I've made, for me, this has provided a great direct outlet to fans, and the fans, all these fans that we just didn't know we had at a certain time for many years, just they haven't stopped since our Blu-ray came out.
And then that's the funny thing about when Blu-rays or things get re-released on Blu-ray or DVD is that there's that reinvigorating of the movie. And then, of course, people like myself try to seek out people that worked on the films to find out more of their story.
It's people like you. I mean, to tell the truth, and I think I still don't think Hollywood has completely figured this out yet, but the people who are intense movie fans and are genre fans, and specifically like horror, science fiction, action movies. I mean, it's, you know, it's actually fairly broad, but it probably centers around horror and science fiction. They've always been the most enthusiastic, demonstrative, supportive fans of any movies, and that's going on to this day, where the fact is that movie theaters, you know, no matter what they're trying to do, are not doing really that well. And, you know, I don't know if they disappear completely, but there may just come a time where there's no major theatrical release of even major films. But the fans, you know, like myself, like you, like a lot of people, we prefer, if it's possible, to see a movie on a big screen, you know, and especially for me, if it's a comedy or a horror movie, I prefer to see it with an audience, because then you're really part of an experience, and it's a group experience. It's something that, you know, when you sit in a comedy and there's like two people in a theater, it's like those two people aren't going to laugh very much. If they're with, you know, 150 other people, it's an entirely different thing. And I like that experience.
Oh, I definitely agree with you. My son and I saw, I think it was Sisu earlier this year.
Oh yeah. I want to see that.
And it was wonderful to see the big screen, and everybody there, when certain kills are happening, everybody's going, ooh, ooh, ooh. You know, it's such a great experience when you hear like 20, 30 or more other people all going with that same thing that you're doing. It just it makes it more enjoyable. It makes it more real, I guess, in a sense.
Well, it's especially great when you're a filmmaker. It's like I started out doing films in high school, and I did comedy shorts. And it was great when I'd make a film, and anytime I showed it to an audience or whatever, I knew exactly where the laughs were. I knew exactly. It was almost like if something didn't get the reaction, I'd have to think about it. Like, what didn't work with this audience?
Yeah, well, sometimes it could be a bunch of reviewers in there, and it's not your typical audience, and then you get your typical
First of all, I mean, that's a totally different type of audience. And with an audience like, you know, when you know you have, I mean, they used to do lots of screenings just for reviewers. They really limit that nowadays. Even reviewers have to find a way to get to a theater or to get a video of some sort just to be able to review something. I still have like a lot of, I read a lot and I'm usually up on what's going on and what the trends in the business are. I still don't know what has replaced advertising, on commercial television of movie commercials, you know, and spot TV spots, which is how most people used to find out about things, and newspapers. Because as it is now, I have to go to YouTube to watch trailers, et cetera, which I'm fine with. But does everybody do that? I mean, I have no idea. You know, it used to sort of be you'd find out about movies because the information would just come at you in between the parts of a TV show. Or you just open up the newspaper and there's always the movie section and you'd probably check it out.
Yeah, I think with YouTube, for me, most of the time I'm seeing them on YouTube like yourself. But it's one of those, before I'm seeing another video, you have those like ads that'll pop up. And a lot of times it's a trailer ad. And you got that 5 to 15 second window before you can hit skip. And if the trailer is hitting you and you're like, wait a minute, or you see an actor or director or something that piques your interest or the type of movie it is, then you'll watch the whole thing. And then if you like it, you share it with your friends. And then of course, so they're,
right.
I guess that's the new way of doing things, that TikTok.
It is, but I mean, I seek out trailers and I see a lot of trailers, but then like 6 months or a year or several years later, I'll say, oh, what's this movie that came out 2 years ago? I never heard of it. I would have been really interested.
That is true. But I think that's always been that way where, you know.
It has to a certain extent, except the difference is there was a time when you had a newspaper, mm-hmm. you just opened up the pages and there were all these movies there. And, you know, I mean, the bigger profile ones had more expensive, bigger ads, but still everything was like right there in front of you. So you had a full idea of what was available to you at that moment. And now it's, you know, I mean, like people ask me, where can they see Street Trash or Spookies? And I'll say, well, I don't know where it's streaming this month. It could be anywhere. It could be, you know, it could be nowhere. It just changes so rapidly.
Street Trash is on Tubi currently.
I heard that and I'm kind of shocked considering it essentially received the equivalent of an X rating.
I can see why when it came out in 1987, it would have received.
Well, no, it came out. I mean, here's the thing. Have you seen Street Trash?
Yes.
Yes. We made the film in addition to just like really over the top bizarre gore effects. We had like, you know, I mean, it's just full of obscenity and filth and offensiveness and whatever. But that was all intentional. And we figured, all right, just everything combined, we're going to get an X rating, right? And we were told that's what we'd get, so we released it unrated. But the fact is the gore, I mean, when people melt and they, you know, and yellow and blue goo comes out of them, is that blood? No. How is that gore?
Well, it depends on the definition. But I got to say, one of my favorite gore scenes in that or melting scenes is the first one. With the guy on the commode. Yeah. I mean, that's just, literally he goes down the drain, down the, you know, the thing. So you couldn't.
Yeah. I mean, I've talked to a few people about that in recent years and most people actually feel that way. And it's weird because it's like, you know, I've thought, well, maybe that should have been the last one we did in the movie but it was so good and it made such an amazing first impression. You know, we never considered it, you know, changing that, the location of that scene or that idea. You know, I think it's, you know, it's a case sometimes where at the same time, I mean, bear in mind that when the film first came out, we didn't have, you know, I can now go, you know, to many places and see dozens and dozens of people's opinions about that film or any film and get a sense of things. And sometimes you see something and you go, oh, all right. Well, that person had a good thought. You know, gee, maybe we should have done something different. Whatever, but I think it works the way it is.
I do love the opening sequence with the one guy stealing the liquor and as the opening credits are going on and it's and how it skips a little in time with each one. Like so, as you're starting in credit. It's I like that as the transition, so it gets.
Well, I mean, you're aware of the situation we had with Spookies, where we were sort of, you know, being supervised and dictated to almost every step of the way. Street Trash was a much more democratic, open situation. I had as much input as I needed to anything at any stage.
Yeah, but I'm going to say the movie starts off with a nice sequence, and then, of course, you got the kill, and it just sets everything up, and then it moves on. I like how a lot of different things happen in it, and I'm just curious, when you were going through, because I knew you were producer of it and things like that, how did it go about, like, with getting certain actors or setting up some of that stuff? You said it was a democratic situation. We'll get to Spookies in a little bit.
Well, I'm simply saying that I was a co-producer with Roy Frumkes, who also wrote the script. Jimmy Muro was the director, 19 years old, had a Steadicam that came into play that we used throughout the picture. And when I say democratic, I simply mean that, like, you know, almost anybody who was involved had some kind of creative capability or judgment. So in a situation like that, I mean, the way I think, and fortunately, that was the tone of the picture. It was like, you know, if somebody had an idea in the middle of shooting or something, they could talk to Jimmy and say, hey, why don't you do this or that? Or, you know, or if somebody, you know, wanted to communicate something to me about how something might, I mean, I want to hear people's ideas. And you, on a picture, sometimes, you know, especially if it's a bigger budget film, there are a lot of things that work against that kind of, you know, way of doing things, including the fact that you have such a large staff that it's very difficult to get through the levels to get that kind of communication. But I just think it was a situation where the film, I think, benefited tremendously by that, because it's all kinds of little quirky moments and things that are in the film and get laughs, etc., were not necessarily in the script. I mean, a lot of it was just, you know, what the tone of that day's shoot happened to be or whatever. It just, certain things work certain ways. And for the most part, most of what we shot, I'd say we were satisfied with. I mean, we cut, there's a lot of stuff that got cut out, mostly for time more than anything else. You know, I mean, I feel as you know, on Spookies, I mean, the end result, myself and Brendan and our partner, Tom Doran, we're just, you know, pretty heartbroken, and it was definitely an obstacle in terms of us continuing to make other films at that time. It's just at least semi-miraculous that people have rediscovered it to the extent that they have. And I always felt they would once it got out there on video again. It just, you know, it had a video cassette, a VHS release in the mid-80s when it first came out. And it was on DVD in Europe and a few other places, but nobody brought it out in any form until the Blu-ray from Vinegar Syndrome, which is like 4 years ago.
Yeah, I was going to say, Spookies, as I know from research and talking to Brendan Faulkner, it had a problematic history dealing with the money man, as I'll call him.
You know, well, have you seen the Spookies documentary?
No, I haven't seen the Spookies documentary because I didn't want it to influence the conversation we're having now.
Right, but you should make an effort to see it, because it's, I think it's a really good expose of sort of something that I think many, many filmmakers go through, where creative people are trying to do something and the money people, who unfortunately are usually short-sighted one way or another, in that they, you know, all they can look at is like, what is this costing? How much am I going to make? Whatever. And they frequently don't understand the value or of the worth of doing something or not doing something a certain way. And the thing is, with Spookies, I think we met, you know, we came face to face with like a genuinely, like, you know, beyond anything you would usually expect. I mean, the problem was, I think we were just dealing with a person who was used to dictating things to people, having total control. He'd become wealthy very fast. Michael Lee was sort of the king of the video nasties in the 80s in Britain when that became a controversy. He was fined a lot, and his films were censored because he was bringing in all these Italian horror movies primarily. So he wanted to start making his own films. He looked around. He eventually found our little group, and we made a film with him. And it's unfortunate because even though we had attempted a few other projects and gotten a few things started but not completed, this was the first full-blown feature film that was fully budgeted that we were doing. And yeah, I mean, we, you know, we made, I think, errors and mistakes and learned things in the process. But this guy was demanding every, I mean, we were, you got to the point with him where you were afraid to say anything because anything you said, he would hold you to, no matter what it was. And a lot of what we were saying, we would know was bullshit because it was the only way to keep things going without him flipping out.
Because yeah, Brendan, I remember telling me that he would just show up at almost any time and then have ideas, which I'm sure you guys would love because here you are, and I'm being sarcastic when I say that for listeners, but here you are, you had this plan, you have everything set up, and he would come in and say, oh, why don't we do this and this and this? And you're right in the middle of shooting stuff from what Brendan was telling me. And sometimes right. Brendan had to like lock him out.
I think part of it is also that he had started a couple of other projects, actually, that never got really off the ground in England before he came here and talked to us. And I think they were much lower budget. And I think he was working with people who were willing to work in a more haphazard sort of freehand way. And, you know, maybe they can do that and it's not going to really make much difference. But we pretty much planned out what we were doing every day of the shoot. We, you know, especially when we had special effects, it's like everything was built around the fact that that was probably going to take a while to get right.
And I know from watching the movie and talking to Brendan and also for talking to you prior to the interview, there was a lot of effect shots that were done that were never seen in the movie and are lost.
Yeah, that's one of the things. The woman who took over the movie from everything I know, and I've heard all sources of information on this, meaning I've heard her version of it. I've heard other people who knew her, their versions of it, various other people that had some one thing or another to do with the recut of the film. And it just seemed in the long run, what happened is she initially was brought in as the new editor. And I think she figured out pretty quickly that she could convince this guy that this film was like unreleasable as it was, which is what she supposedly said. And bear in mind, we had a rough cut. And all that was needed was climactic special effects, optical effects, which a member of our team was doing. And somehow he was convinced that most of the film didn't work and should be thrown away. And she convinced him to give her money to direct and write new scenes, an entirely secondary storyline integrated into the film. In some cases, at very bizarre moments where it's like she would literally like take a shot of like somebody opening a door and then show the other side with like one of the characters from her movie, you know, closing the door or something like that, to give the impression that they were in proximity. But one of the really bizarre things is she cut down all of our monster scenes, which are the meat of the movie. I mean, without those, there would be no reason for the movie, really, as far as we were concerned. That was our intent from the start. I don't get it. It's a lot of the stuff plays now in like I'd say most of the actual monster scenes, the time spent with the monster or a scene involving the monster, most of those scenes are like 30 seconds. Literally. I mean, it's just like things happen really quickly and then it's over. And in almost every case, there was just more stuff. The scene when they go into the basement and they meet the muck men, who everybody somehow thinks are zombies, but they're not zombies. There were originally in the scene, there were three of them. The way it's cut now, it looks like there are two of them. And interestingly, I've clocked the running time on our footage versus the footage that was added. And it's like literally like, you know, 49% versus 51%. It's like she made sure there were at least a little bit, there was at least a little bit more of her stuff than our stuff, even if she had to cut the monster scenes down.
Which, well, now we obviously know why she probably did it, you know, so she had the majority.
Well, I can understand that, but I still don't get it. It's like, because not that I would do such a thing, but if I were her, it would seem logical to me to like, all right, this is like the money stuff. Sorry. So I'll leave this in. I'll cut out this scene of somebody talking or somebody, you know, or whatever instead. But I don't think she did it with skill. I think she did it with ultimately her intention, her goal was to insert her half of the movie into the movie.
Because I think, if I remember right, Brendan said you guys had going into the rough cut, you know, which was going to be, you know, edited and put out for the final film eventually. I think it was like 2 hours and 20 minutes of footage, you know, from the rough cut, something like that.
And when we say rough cut, it's like none of the edits were tight, you know, meaning almost every shot. It was just, there might be like all kinds of bullshit in between cuts of shots and stuff because it was just loose. And in some cases, we'd include shots that, you know, were part of a scene that really had, we hadn't quite figured out exactly how to integrate them into the scene. And so that, you know, you'd see something repeated or whatever, but that's a typical rough cut. It's just like everything that we think we can use sort of very roughly cut together. And that way, you know, we look at it. And he, I mean, part of what sparked the problem is he, at that point, decided to show it to a film executive from a company that came into town, screened it for him. And this, unfortunately for me, this happened to be a guy I had known from a few years back. And so I was like totally embarrassed. I just felt, oh God, it's like, we don't want anybody to see this.
Yeah, I know from what Brendan was saying, he was going to, the finished product that you guys probably would have had done would have probably been like an hour and 40-ish minutes, you know? So that's what he was thinking.
And at that time, most of those films were between 80 to 95 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, so that was like about the range, you know, and we would have cut it, you know, we would have cut it as much as we felt it worked and it played and et cetera. I don't think there was any wisdom to what was done to it. I later learned and heard from another source and another filmmaker that she did a very similar thing with somebody else's film, where she sort of pushed herself into it and reshot the whole film.
Some people are just opportunistic like that, and that's just the way it is, you know, and they're able to get into certain positions and do it.
Right. They tried to interview her for the documentary. They couldn't find her, even though she was around. We knew she was around. In the early days of the internet, we were able to dig up like magazine articles where she's bragging about, you know, what she did making the film and bullshitting like shamelessly, including saying that she directed the original directors.
Well, there's another interview I did with a director, Michael Wirth. And in IMDb, I forgot the movie's title, but he was listed as a co-director. And
right.
Somehow, like during the interview, it came up, he was talking about one actor he worked with. And I remember it being in that movie. And I said, oh, do you mean that movie that you co-directed? And he was like, I've never co-directed a movie in my life. And this person never directed any of it, but yet went on these different tours with the movie, you know, we're going around and going to different festivals, and was doing seminars about how to direct. And this person did not direct any of it, but yet they were taking the credit as being the director and running with it. And it happens. I think all the time. These are just ones I'm hearing about, but I'm sure if it's happened to two different groups, you know, it's happened hundreds of times at least with other people. And it's sad some people just do that and they feel the need to take the credit.
Well, the one thing that's been a constant, I think, almost since the start of movies is that because there's fame involved, even more so than money, it's like there's fame and that's a certain kind of notoriety and a lot of people crave that, right? And there are a lot of people in show business, and I would say especially actors, who, you know, they want to be seen, they want to be known, they want fame. I have, since Spookies was re-released and proved to be a hit with fans all these years later, I now have fans. I now have people who want to talk to me and like interview me. And you know, it's, and I dig that. And right now I'm simply looking at it because I want to, as much as I can, I want to exploit this and make some more movies. And that's my intention right now. But I just feel like, I would be nowhere without fans. I would be, unable to even consider this. And, it just makes all the difference in the world to suddenly feel you've succeeded at something that you had assumed for a good portion of your life was maybe your greatest failure, you know, beyond your control, but still a failure.
Well, it's, Exactly. You know, where you ended up going against an irresistible force of nature in Michael Lee, and which drove you guys absolutely insane. I know from talking to, like I said, both you and Brendan, and you never know. It's like, was that his arterial motive? Was like, if I drive these guys nuts enough, they'll leave. You never know. Who knows why people do the things they do? It seems like you guys had this wonderful idea. And if I remember, Brendan was talking, the things he was looking at was have the most amount of monsters ever in a movie. Like, he wanted to have tons of monsters, lots of monsters.
Well, I mean, his initial pitch to us is, he said, I want a movie just like The Evil Dead. And I wanted to, and they walk into a room and a ghost pops out, and they walk into another room and a skeleton pops out or whatever it is. And so, we said, Artie wants a movie with lots of monsters. Now, we had another idea that we were actually preparing and looking to raise money for that he rejected, which was another movie in an old house. There was one central monster. But it was a lot better written. The characters were interesting, and there was, you know, something going on between them instead of them just sort of being there because you need characters. And the problem is that in the current version, which a lot of that stuff is cut out, you don't even get the slightest sense of what's going on with the characters. You know, because when they're introduced, you get some idea who they are, what the relationship is, why this one older guy is with all these younger people. You know, not that I ever think really that's such a big deal, but people make a big deal out of it.
Yeah, it is cut weird, but I mean, or edited weirdly, but that was just the nature of the person doing it, which we talked about. And I don't know if they really knew how to craft the editing well, or just because they're trying to get their story in. It's hard to say.
I think it has more to do with them trying to, I mean, because some of the new material was obviously written specifically to get shots that could be inserted into other scenes. Bear in mind, she, you know, her primary, you know, work was as a porn editor. She had been an adult film star, actually a fairly well-known one, for a number of years, and had started to get into editing, and I guess wanted to direct. And, I have to say, I do resent how opportunistic she was. A lot of filmmakers would love, you know, would say, oh, gee, if somebody came to me with a film that wasn't finished and it needed fixing and I could get a credit, they take the opportunity. But, you know, in fact, that was the way when we first, you know, dealt with Michael. He had a film he wanted us to come in and try and fix. And, you know, we could have, I guess, done something similar. But what we actually said is, there's nothing worth saving here. We just said that, like, immediately.
Is this the film that ended up, I think he asked if you guys could drive down to Andy Milligan, and even Milligan didn't want to take it?
Yeah. And Milligan, I mean, I don't know if you've seen Milligan's films, but...
I've seen some.
His films are incredibly inept, but in ways that most other low-budget films aren't. He'll shoot an entire film that seems to be all really tight close-ups, for instance. He'll dwell on certain things that make you think almost like he's got something on his mind, and then you soon realize he doesn't.
Milligan is definitely an interesting filmmaker, but I got to give him credit. He got films done. You know, I mean, there's a lot of people that want to be filmmakers.
He had some reputation as a stage director in New York City before he did films. So, and I think that's why you get a lot, his films are filled with lots of eccentric actors and eccentric performances. So I think that was really like sort of what he used as his advantage in many ways, that a lot of film directors, low budget film directors at least, don't necessarily have. I don't know what to say. If that other film had been finished by Andy Milligan, there would be no Spookies.
Yeah, but there might have been Twisted Souls. So you never know.
Oh, I don't know, because we wrote Twisted Souls to try and figure out a way to make something out of the story we were told we had to do. And it was us who said, Artie, he wants ghosts and things popping up. You know, we'll just make it like completely unusual, out of, you know, not at all typical monsters. You know, you'll have one every like 15 minutes or so. You know, and that was our intent, and that's really from the start where we knew that was going to be the selling point of the film. That's where we were going to get to do something that we felt could be worthwhile, and if nothing else, we'd have these great special effects scenes to point to. Now, despite all the problems, despite the fact that those scenes were cut down and in many ways just like, you know, weakened in the editing, those are still the strong point of the movie, and that's what people talk about. And it's great to hear people praising us for that, because from the start, even if the movie had been our movie and that was what was released, you know, we were still, you know, we were under pressure to do a certain movie, a certain type of way, et cetera. But we knew the monsters would be good. So I'm just glad that more or less survived.
I love the monsters in it. And I know there was I'm trying to remember the Spider Woman type one, where I just loved that. I think that's the one that Brendan was telling me was going to have stop motion effects with.
It did. I don't know exactly what the situation was, but I seem to remember seeing either test footage or shots of the stop motion cut in. There was that, but there was also mechanical spiders. Oh. Meaning there's like a shot. There's a shot where the Spider Woman is there, like in one of the middle transformations or something, on either side of her, these sort of ornate wooden boxes, and they open up. And then, like, the character who dies in that scene, the actor is Pete Isillo, but you see him, like, a giant spider is on top of him. But there was more build up to that, and they crawl out of these boxes and move towards him. And one of the things she cut out by cutting those scenes down is there's no suspense in any of those scenes. It's everything just happens, bang, 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 which is fine, but there's no buildup. There's not even a moment to, like, you know, get the audience scared, even though people have told me they're scared by spookies. I don't know how, but.
Well, it just goes to show you that if they would have saw your guys' version, they would have been even more scared, you know, because the tension would have been built enough.
You know, I mean, you got to realize, I think we would have made any movie that anybody would have financed at the time. And in the case of most filmmakers, that's frequently the case, that you just, you know, it's like you have things you want to do, and then money comes out of nowhere, and somehow you may have to do something you have no interest in doing, you don't think is worth doing.
But if that thing does well, then you got the money possibly for the project you want to do, so then you can actually fund the project you want.
Right, well, that was our intention with Spookies. All right, well, we'll make this film, and it's more or less the kind of thing we want to do, except we're sort of forced due to the backer. It's probably a lot, like, dumber and more, silly than we would probably choose to do in a lot of ways. It's more cliche. It's more, you know, because if you look at the other 80s horror films that came out around, you know, the 80s, I mean, there were like 100 ripoffs one way or another of The Evil Dead. And I don't believe in ripoff movies. I don't think that's why people want to see a movie. I mean, there's a certain percentage of the audience who's like, oh, well, I liked that zombie movie and this other movie has zombies, so obviously I'll like this movie. But I don't know. I think you need something more than that.
Oh, I agree. It's just like everything in Hollywood or filmmakers. When they find the hot thing, the producers want to strike while everybody's there wanting it. Like when Star Wars hit big, suddenly there was tons and tons and tons of Star Wars knockoffs, you know, right in that late 70s, early 80s period. And same thing with Sword and Sandals type movies. When Conan hit big,
right? No, I mean, it always happens, but it's, how can I put it? It just seems like a lot of stuff is so lazy in terms of, you know, it's one thing to steal somebody's ideas. It's another thing to just basically like carbon copy something I mean, my favorite example is like a lot of the zombie movies of the 80s that came out of Italy, which were ripoffs of Dawn of the Dead that created like a worldwide sensation at the time. And Italian movies are hilarious to me, and a lot of European movies, because they'll rip off like totally superficial elements of, you know, like they'll have a character that has a similar name as an actor in another movie that they're ripping off, right? Or they'll have like in I can't remember which Italian zombie movie it is, but like there's the in Dawn of the Dead, there's the scenes where all the guys, the special forces guys, are running around and all that, and they've got these blue uniforms. There's an Italian movie where all these guys are running around in blue uniforms to duplicate that to some extent. I don't know how that brings people into see your movie.
I don't know either, but I guess but there are people that love those things. And when I was meeting with the sword, like when there was a bunch of sword and sandal ones or whatever, and some of them are really good, you know, some right. of them, or a lot of them are okay. And there's some of them that you watch and you're just like, as you were saying with things, they made a copy. They just did it. Boom. It's quick. You can tell there was virtually like no budget, no care. And it came out. You can have no budget, but if you have a lot of care, it can be good.
A lot of filmmakers who are making ripoffs of other movies can make great films.
Exactly.
You know, it depends on how much freedom do you have, how much money do you have. You know, you can still do great work. That mm-hmm. there's nothing stopping that. But I don't have a place in my heart for the things that I feel are just so incredibly lazy that you know they barely even attempt to do anything differently or good for that matter.
Oh, I definitely agree. And one thing we haven't talked about yet is what led you to go into the film industry, to become a filmmaker back when you were growing up? Was it a certain love for certain films that you saw?
I had an interest in films starting at maybe the age of 12 or so. Right. And I started I was getting into, you know, monster movies and horror and science fiction and stuff. And then, and my tastes like from there broadened tremendously. I also got, I was a filmmaker on, pardon me, a film collector on 8mm. So I collected a lot of like silent comedies and things like that. And that's another genre that I became eventually a big aficionado of. You know, it's sort of, it's nowadays people, most of what people are exposed to, younger people, is relatively recent stuff, you know, and you have to search, you always have. But more than ever, you have to search. All the older stuff is now available almost, right? But you have to go looking for it. I think the average audience member is there, as far as they look, is like, oh, all right, what's on Max tonight? You know?
Yep. Yeah, they'll look back to them 20 years ago was old. You know, it depends on, especially depending on their age, anything, you know, beyond 20 years to them, is it old movie and is it worth going back to? You know, I'm talking mostly about teenagers and those in their 20s, but you do have the exceptions that go back and really.
My feeling is, unfortunately, that the vast majority of movies today can't hold a candle to almost any decade of filmmaking prior. It's, you know, it's really unfortunate. I mean, I will admit there's like, there are differences that I like. I mean, I think because television suddenly became big budget and became cinematic and started to look like actual movies, there's some very good work got done, you know. I think that's terrific. But, you know, at the same time, you know, the technology is giving like people with almost no money the ability to make movies, and lots of people are taking advantage of that. And to me, it sort of separates the men from the boys, so to speak, in that it's like, all right, you have like next to no money to shoot this. You have a camera. Camera gives a pretty good image. What can you do, right? Somebody with talent and the ability to think and plan something and visualize can do really good work. Other directors, including directors whose names would be known by most people, a lot of them don't really think about that stuff at all. It's like, you know, they have a script. They think about the acting and the dialogue. The cameraman sets up the shots. You know, they have enough different takes and everything so they can cut together a scene. But they're not thinking of a cinematic scene. They're just, you know, like, how do I get the dramatic or the comedy done in the scene? And then, you know, we have all these shots and we'll figure out how to cut it together. I don't believe in that kind of movie making myself.
Yeah, I guess some people could say they're workmanlike or whatever, but because the creativity is not there, or the ability to look beyond what they're filming at that moment. You know, some people are able to play multidimensional chess, and other people are only able to play one or two moves ahead.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I was thinking about this just the other day that, I mean, somebody, you can be a terrible director, but if you somehow luck into a situation where you've made a film, and it's made money, and people are suddenly wanting more from you. They won't even, I don't even think they have the ability to judge how little talent they have. All they're looking at is how much money did you make for them or somebody else? And you'll get work. And other people who might, you know, be brilliant are having a hard time. You know, and this has always gone on. I think it goes hand in hand with the arts and the fact that films still, as much as they're able to get made more quickly and efficiently, and I think, in fact, this is one of my beliefs, and I still think that Hollywood hasn't figured this out yet. You know, all the recent strikes and everything are sort of exemplary of this. But I think the whole economic balance of the system has to change, mainly because it's. I watched a video yesterday. There's a new film out called Creator.
Yes.
Yeah, science fiction film, right?
Yep.
It was shot with a $4,000 camera. Right. Now realize, like, the average cell phone can get an image that you couldn't get, you know, with almost anything except a 35mm camera at one time, you know, in terms of the density of the image and the crispness and the quality overall. But I think the fact that something like that is possible, and I mean other people, like the director Steven Soderbergh has said he just wants to shoot his movies on iPhones from now on, right? Meanwhile, there's still all these big companies that have made expensive movie equipment for years and are still making it, right? They don't want to have to, you know, to say, oh, gee, good news, we have this camera that only costs a few thousand dollars. You don't have to spend $300,000 on your cameras to get the image that you want, right? There are times where I'll see a video or a picture of a production being done, right? And they've got a camera. I mean, and I've seen this both ways. I've seen it where they've still got some giant video camera that's like the size of an old Arriflex or another, you know, standard 35mm camera from the time, you know, where it's like, it's a pretty big deal. It's like two people have to lift it up to get it on a tripod. And it's not like it's just simple and convenient, right? And they're still making stuff that's big scale and that people are using and paying big money for. At the same time, they're making much less expensive equipment. A lot of filmmakers, including big filmmakers, are using that and you know, other forms of video. And occasionally I'll see something where they've got like a big, you know, like a dolly or something designed for a huge camera. You know, and there's some little thing on top of it that looks like a pack of cigarettes or something. You know, that's the camera.
It's just the visual, you know, it's just, you just got to laugh when you picture that visual. It's like this huge box car, like device almost, you know, and then you got this small little thing on top that's carrying.
I mean, I I'm still baffled by the fact that I see great looking images done by people who have no money. And I'll see other stuff where I know money was spent and it still looks like crap. It's really hard for a video to look like crap nowadays.
It goes back to what you were saying earlier with the creativity with the cinematographer and the director, whatever their vision is. And there are a lot of directors that are not really good visually, but if the cinematographer is not that talented, then you're at a double.
Yeah, I'm very visually oriented and I like that kind of a director, but I have no problem with somebody whose main talent is working with actors, or maybe it's just a writer who also wants to direct his own stuff or whatever. I mean, if they're getting what they want and, you know, there's no reason they can't have great work of that sort. It's not the direction I think in and would pursue. But I don't know. I mean, I'd say all my favorite directors are very obsessive visually in terms of what they do. A lot of the, you know, the standard ones that people would think of, Scorsese and Kubrick and Orson Welles and, you know, many others. But I like to see as many different films as I can. I like to find obscure movies from the past and from other countries. And I like to have my sensibilities challenged.
And I think that's, you know, myself too, as a film enthusiast, it's the same as yourself and most people that are film enthusiasts. We love to see a wide variety of genres, of filmmakers, of film types, even ones that are not normally your go-to style. You like to see, it's like, okay, have they improved? How's this person bringing it? Because it might be, you never know. You might hit somebody that has this thing that you don't normally like, but the way they did it, you enjoy that.
Right. Well, I mean, I always think I can learn something from anything, any piece of art, you know, whatever. But I also, there are times, I mean, there are films I will watch knowing that I'm probably not going to like this film, but it's supposedly a great film and it's supposedly by a great director. But I generally don't like this director's films and I generally don't like this kind of film, but I'll watch it, like I'll take it like it's bad tasting medicine. And sometimes I'm very happy that I did, and other times I realize how right I was.
But you never know without having tried it. And that's the whole thing. You know, you got to experience it in order to know one way or the other, you know. And also, as everything in life, our tastes change. Things that you liked when you were 12 is not the same things you like now in some aspects. Some things stayed the same. Some things have altered, just like with everybody.
Well, I try to keep my tastes expanding. You know, I don't want to become like the old man yelling at the cloud type of thing. You know, I don't want to feel like, all right, well, I'm just boxed into this place where I don't really want to see I really can't appreciate anything to the left or right. You know, I mean, I think, for instance, I don't usually like, you know, get like pissed off or talk about how, oh, gee, we used to know what we were doing and now everything sucks. I would never take that kind of an attitude. I think certain things do suck. I think it's more for commercial reasons. I also think, I've never seen anybody ever write anything about this, but I've always thought that every time there's a big technical revolution, the quality of movies like plummets. This happened in the early sound era. This happened in the days where television started to change the whole look of everything, and movies started doing television techniques and everything. And the movies, a lot of them suffered in terms of what they looked like around that time, right? And it's happened again now with video technology making things so easy that people think they don't have to care about good lighting or other things. You know, at the same time, I'm seeing some of the most beautiful stuff I've ever seen visually.
Mm-hmm. Going for you, sometimes the most beautiful things with the ability for people to put in computer graphics and to do that in movies.
Hang on one second. Keep talking. I just have to go shut an alarm on. Go ahead. Talk.
But I was looking at it with the CGI technology and the digital technology nowadays, where you can actually enhance certain images or backgrounds, is so great where people can do that. But then on the other hand, they get a little lazy. For instance, instead of having somebody who's in an office, like you and I, you're sitting in a chair in a building. Well, that doesn't cost much to get a chair in a practical set, but yet they'll have a chair and they'll green screen everything else around them. And I'm saying, yes, just because you can do that, doesn't mean you should do it.
In some cases, I understand because, you know, I don't have a problem with it being done where it's like, oh, all right, we're doing this instead of buying, you know, like $2 million worth of materials to build the same thing. But I mean, I hate sloppy thinking. I mean, Cecilia Cosentini, who was one of our art directors on Spookies, she did a lot of computer graphics work like, for a while back in the 90s, especially worked on like the first version of Dune and other stuff, you know, with part teams that won Emmys, etc. But I've heard of her working on things where, like, you know, somebody shot a scene and somebody's supposed to be coming down like through, you know, a manhole or something, right? And, you know, they'll just like, you know, they'll come in the top, there's no manhole there. You can see like a curtain waving. It's like, you can basically see this is fake. And they're shooting it, expecting just somebody to fix it. It's like, they could have very easily done something to make it okay on the set. But I think they just assume, oh, well, you know, somebody will just fix it in post.
Exactly. But that I can understand a little bit, but I'm just meaning like if somebody's just in an office setting or something, and there are going to be a lot of scenes in the office where now that the actor doesn't have anything to work with as much. And I can tell with looking at it sometimes because it doesn't look as good, whatever reason it didn't fit. And I'm looking and saying, wait a minute, I don't think that's real. I don't think they're really, like, he's really in an office. And then you do a little research and you find that there's a picture. There they are sitting in a chair at their desk and everything's all, and I'm just like,
right.
Why? You know, especially I can understand if they're taking somebody who's in a different country and they're trying to put him into a different spot. That I can understand and I can buy, you know, they don't want to fly him in. So they're like, oh, we're going to do this. I'm fine with that. I understand it. But when you could tell they're the star of the show and they're green screening an office that you can repurpose, or, you know, it's all you have to do is just put some set dressing there and boom, you're done. I think it'd have to be cheaper than doing the CGI, but I don't know.
I mean, I can't say, because it probably is. It's a matter of each production and what individual decisions they made about what was most beneficial. I mean, I see CGI can be, you know, a great tool. It's done some great things. It's made some great images happen in a lot of films. At the same time, and like I said, for sets, for backgrounds, I think, you know, I have no complaints there for the most part. For things like creatures, monsters, aliens, other things, sometimes the illusion is there and I'm perfectly fine with it. Other times, and this is especially true with, how can I put it? For me, anything that involves like effects that I don't see, and that I can't think of any equivalent I've ever seen in real life. Like when there's something, you know, there's a robot and all kinds of energy is crackling around him and say that, and it's, you know, it's almost like a more sophisticated version of the stuff they would do in the 80s where they do cell animation over something. But either way, I look at that and I go, all right, I have never seen anything like that in reality. If there was electricity doing that, it wouldn't look like that. So for me, it's like, yeah, it's a nice visual, but I don't buy it.
Yeah, I mean, I understand where they're going and what they're doing. And like, just make sure listeners understand, I like most of the CGI that films do. It's just sometimes it's sloppy, which, you know, that could be anything with CGI or practical effects or anything. But I just...
That even happens to a lot of any major CGI films have scenes that look sloppy because they're so eager to just get them out in front of the public.
Or they didn't give them the effects team enough time to finish, or money, or both. And because they're like, oh, we got to make it because this film's supposed to be out in time for the Christmas season this year, blah, blah, blah. And it's got to be there, hell or high water. And, you know, and then things have to be rushed.
So, I mean, like, if you look at like the Marvel movies, I love the first, 15 or so Marvel movies. And then it started to wear thin. But I think that's happened with most of the public. And for me, part of the thing that's been a problem, and this is almost from the start, but where they pretty much like entire scenes, they dispense with live actors completely, and all the fighting is, it's just, it's very obvious to me as CGI, because, I mean, there's motion and there's stuff that happens, your brain rejects that. And it's a sophisticated cartoon, but it's really a cartoon as opposed to something real that your mind doesn't, you know, have any kind of an issue with.
Oh, I agree with you 100% on that. It's just, it's done well, it hits you, and you don't, and you can flow right in with the fantasy. But once you're, and everybody has a different level, everybody has a different threshold when they're gonna hit, but once that threshold is passed, you know, once they're reached, it's hard for you then to stay in with the movie. You know, it's that part of the movie where it kicks you out of it. And for some people, they're able to take it a high bar. It just depends how the movie's going, how the acting's going, how everything is going. You can usually give things. Movies I'll give mulligans to, I call it, like, just because I'm enjoying it too much. I was like, oh, I'm enjoying all these other things.
No. If you're digging something, if something's working for you and then suddenly there's like a bad special effect, you know, you'll just like in an instant, your mind will go, oh, well, yeah, that's okay. Doesn't matter.
Exactly. And for low budget films, I usually will have a higher tolerance because I just know, okay, they're going for something. They're trying to reach for something their budget would never allow, but at least they're reaching and they're showing. And
they're reaching for it. And in some cases they come through and they accomplish what they're trying to do. You know, I think it's, you know, it's a matter of like having a, you know, like, again, a vision and a way of trying to do something that, I mean, because with CGI, I mean, bear in mind that in most cases, the CGI is handed over to a CGI house, right? The director may have involvement, but the director is not necessarily directing every one of those scenes or shots. And, you know, and they'll work out stuff. And they've got, you know, they've got CGI characters that they can then take and, you know, rearrange in space on online and, you know, pretty much, you know, shoot it or frame it or angle it or redo it any way that they can think of. So in if you notice that a lot of movies that have amazing special effects and, but aren't especially good movies, right? I think this is a tradition with special effects teams, right? Where there's like major portions of certain movies, you go, wow, all this is great, but the movie part with the people is not quite so great.
Yeah, the heart of the movie, so to speak, is not, you don't feel it. And I don't want to pick on CGI. I just mean different techniques that filmmakers can do. Some people will do certain things and it's just because they want to do it, but it doesn't fit that movie. But those that it would fit the movie, I appreciate them so much for doing that reach, because if you didn't have that, I mean, that goes all the way back to the beginning of film history. If you didn't have filmmakers trying to do those certain techniques, just because people say, oh, we can't do this, but they would find a way to try to make it work. A lot of times they succeeded. Sometimes they didn't. But then the next filmmaker, or maybe that same filmmaker on their next attempt, would find a way to make that work the way they were trying, because they couldn't figure it out at that particular moment of time.
Right.
And that's the beauty, pushing the boundaries. I'm fine with people pushing the boundaries. Because as you said with the silent movies, like the 1927 Napoleon, where a lot of those movie techniques that he was just doing, the director, you know, had cameras on horses, cameras here, cameras
there. No, I mean, he was using anything that came to his head, he wanted to get on the screen somehow. And that's exactly the kind of filmmaking that I appreciate, where somebody is like saying, all right, what if I did this? Oh, wait a minute, what about that? You know, they can, and I get excited when I come up with stuff that I go, wow, has anybody ever done it this way? It's the same reason that so much filmmaking just leaves me cold, meaning it's just sort of, yeah, it's perfectly fine, it's standard, it's adequate, it fulfills whatever purpose it's supposed to serve. It doesn't get me excited or enthusiastic about it in any way.
Yeah, some filmmakers are able to keep the heart going, and other people, it's like I used the word earlier, it's workmanlike. It's acceptable. You can take it for what it is, and sometimes the acting
that's always
is really
been the case. And there's certain kinds of movies that are fine like that because they don't really need certain things. Although in today's atmosphere, everything has to be bigger than life or something. I honestly don't know how films that are simply dramatic films even get made anymore. I mean, far fewer of them do, but even the ones that do, tend to have a time finding an audience, et cetera. The film this past year that sort of broke the mold to some extent was the film Oppenheimer, because it was a very serious film that a lot of people wanted to see. But that kind of film used to be fairly commonplace.
It used to be you would see those at least 10, 12 times a year, and especially a bunch near the end of the year in time for Oscar season. Like these are around the holidays.
Oh, well, that's the other thing too. The whole balance, I mean, part of it is the balance of the Oscars completely changed. There was a time when if you wanted a Best Picture nomination, you better be making a serious dramatic film of some sort that has some kind of a core meaning and is, you know, rises above whatever genre you're working in. You had to have some kind of pretension to something worthwhile, right? And in recent years, I mean, when Marvel movies started winning, you know, awards and things like this, you just sort of figure, oh, okay. the fact that the Joker movie won, that's a movie that, I have to admit, I haven't seen Joker, but I want to see it, and I might very well like it. But I can't get over the fact that it's like a blatant ripoff of Taxi Driver and King of Comedy. I mean, like so much a blatant ripoff that, you know, nobody has hesitated to discuss this, and yet they still see it, you know, as this separate entity. And I don't, for me, I have issues with that. I mean, I have to see the movie, though.
I can see where you're coming from, because I remember seeing the trailer, and I thought the same thing with those types of movies taken it, but I guess the reason people hold it in such high regard is because for a superhero movie, it was going a different direction.
Yeah, like, but I don't think it did anything that bold. All it did is explore the psychological issues of the Joker or the potential Joker, because they're obviously doing different things with the character, you know? So, I mean, and it just, I mean, they're doing the sequel now and, you know, it just seems like, all right, this is the grunge Joker.
And there are people that I know that don't like the Joker, you know, and it's just, every movie that has a different audience for it. And that's the beauty of it. And then some movies come out ahead of its time. Some movies were just not marketed correctly and didn't find their right audience. And then years later, they find an audience, you know, like, wow, people really enjoyed that. And then I know for you as a filmmaker, then you're like, when you go to different conventions or people reach out to you, you find that, oh, they really did like it. Yeah, you know, because nowadays it's so easy to find out from the public which way they feel about stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, the problem is also that it's become like, you know, it's a thing where because it's a public discourse, a lot of it, you know, people are, you know, feel so free to just, you know, throw their opinions left and right like arrows. And, you know, I really get annoyed by so many people who obviously know very little about what they're saying, who have such strong opinions, to, you know, that and are unable to accept the opinions of others. You know, I always love discussing things, but I'm not usually looking to fight with people over them.
Well, there's some people, you know, like they're the trolls. They're whatever. If everybody's loving something, they're going to not love it, and they're just going to stay that way because that way they get their, well, people are commenting on my post because I didn't like it. So, and even you wonder if they're really being honest with their appraisal or they're just doing it so they can get the
in some cases, it's kind of obvious that people are just looking to get a reaction. I'm always annoyed when I, you know, I'll see something and it says like, oh, well, I just saw this new movie and it sucks for this reason and that reason, and it does nothing but suck. No movie is that bad. You know, it's sort of, it's an all or nothing approach that doesn't make any sense to me. And this is the kind of thing that you would hear years ago from people and then you pay no attention to them, but now they're actually in a forum where other people are going to feed into that. So, yeah. But I think it's good. I think the internet in general is a good thing myself.
Yeah. And for those that get some of those things, you can do what I kind of do. You see it, you don't have to read their comments. I mean, you can just avoid it. You can just ignore it. It's not that hard to do.
Yeah. And to tell the truth, in years past, I've like reacted to shit and then I just got to the point where I said, all right, I have no time to deal with this nonsense. I mean, even if I see it, I don't care how pissed off it makes me. I'm not going to bother to have anything to do with it. You know, and I also just think so many people who have online opinions have no qualifications to be making such a public display of their opinions.
Now, if I know that person and made the comment and I'll see him later on in real life or talk to him on the phone, then I'll discuss it with them because it's something, right. Everybody acts differently when you're able to communicate either via Zoom, phone, or in person than they do when you're behind that keyboard.
The same people who have knocked down, drag out, you know, fights online in a forum or something and start name calling and et cetera. If they had this discussion in a living room somewhere, none of this would be happening.
Exactly. So my whole thing is, okay, if I'm going to comment on something, would I say this to the person if I was there with them? You know, and if I'm like, yeah, I would. Okay. Then I'll put that in. If it's something I'll be like, no, I probably wouldn't say that if I was there with them, then I'll just be like, I'll type it. You know, sometimes you type it and then you just hit unsend, or not unsend, but delete. You just delete the whole thing because that way you vented it out.
Like I said, when I've gotten caught up in something like this in the past, it's usually simply because somebody said something outrageous and I was, you know, all I could do was have it in my instant reaction. It was like, what the fuck? You know, and you just that's a normal reaction, I think. But I think the way it extends and prolongs in a space where nobody can see each other and everybody's just letting, you know, out their venom, I don't think that accomplishes anything.
Oh, I agree. I agree. And you got to work in a small role, but you still got to work with one of the well-renowned independent directors in George Romero. Because I did mention Dawn and did, and you got to play Zombie. And now I know there's a lot of fans who of George Romero's work who would give almost anything to have been a zombie in a Romero movie. End of story, you know. Because I mean, you know, come on, he's like the godfather of.
Well, for me, it was like I was dying to see Night of the Living Dead before I saw it. I don't know if you've ever read the infamous article, the review of it by Roger Ebert. Back in the early 70s, probably, he claimed it was playing kiddie matinees and then condemned it on every level, you know, mostly because he was outraged that it was playing kiddie matinees, supposedly, right? So it's like this totally grim, horrendous negative review. By the time Dawn of the Dead came out, he gave a rave review to Dawn of the Dead and apologized for the review of Night of the Living Dead. So I had read his review prior to seeing Night of the Living Dead. When I started a film society in high school, the way I got to see Night of the Living Dead is that's the first film that our film society rented, right? And I've really loved it ever since then, because I still think it's like, for what it is, it works in every way. It's just it does all the right things. And I had the chance, to meet George, to meet his crew and cast, and hang out for, I was there for, I guess, 2 days. But I really, I felt really so delighted at that time because, I mean, George was like somebody who was like, he was an up-and-coming hero of mine from like years before. And suddenly, there's a sequel to Night of the Living Dead. Do you want to be a zombie? Well, yeah, of course. Which is why we drove for 12 hours in a blizzard to get there. But at the same time, I don't think we or anybody working on that at the time had any idea how big a worldwide phenomenon the whole zombie thing would become. And Dawn of the Dead was really the thing that spurred all of that. And George also, I interviewed him and got a fair amount of time to speak with him. He was just, he just struck me as such a nice person. He was very relaxed on the set, knew exactly what he wanted. The stuff he shot that Brendan and I appear in was stuff that he had in his head that wasn't in the script, that he still had a few days and he had some budget left over. And he was just shooting ideas that were coming to him after the primary script had been shot. And I remember being truly astounded that our scenes made it into the movie.
And that's the thing where, a director is like, okay, you're done. In a sense, you're done. But you're like, I got the time. I got the money. I got the location still. Let's film some other stuff. And you never know.
I think also it was at a time where he had already realized that a lot of his script was sort of pushing the boundaries of what these kind of movies are supposed to be able to do. I mean, he was already doing, the central conceit of the movie is really something that no one had ever done before, which is mixing horror with action, but to that extent. No one had ever done anything quite like that. And then to have a level of satire running through it and to be treating the zombies as jokes in some of the scenes and all, that really just took the whole genre in a million different directions at once. And people have been ripping off that movie ever since, pretty much.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and I gotta ask you now: are you a fan of the walking zombies, or do you like the fast zombies, or you don't care?
I think a zombie is supposed to be a reanimated corpse, right? Meaning that has no will of its own. The fast moving type zombie strikes, and it's usually portrayed this way in most of the movies that have been done using that type of zombie. It's usually a virus, and they have a virus. They're not dead; they have a virus. All right, and that works for me fine. And those movies are different; they have a different level of focus. And I think that goes sort of in hand with doing that genre as an action type of thing. But the slow zombies, the traditional ones that existed before Romero's movies, which is what he sort of adapted into what he did. The idea there is, they're slow, but they keep coming and they keep coming, and then there's more of them, and then there's more of them, and it, and that has its own, kind of a terror to it. that it's like no matter what you do, you can run, whatever, that, you know, they're very slow, but eventually they can get to you, and eventually there's going to be more. And that's different than an attack by a bunch of, you know, screaming, foaming mouthed, you know, lunatics. There have been, I think, good movies and other, you know, and at this point, TV shows done in both genres. I mean, there was a Korean show that I saw a couple of years ago called, I think it's called All of Us Are Dead, which took place mostly at a high school in Korea during a zombie thing. And it was just really well done. You know, the characters were well drawn, the situations were well drawn. And it was literally like 12 or more episodes that all take place at this high school.
Yeah, I think there was also, wasn't there a Korean film, The Last Train or The Train to Busan?
Oh, Train to Busan, yeah. Well, that sort of started the Korean zombie thing. And that's a very good film. That's probably one of the best genre films of recent years. It's very suspenseful. You know, you really empathize for the characters. You know, it's got the right elements.
It's gut-wrenching how the emotional punch it packs through the movie. And with the zombie frills for horror fans that are looking for certain things, but it really is
right
beyond just a horror film. It's really just had that emotional impact of how it's affecting.
Right. And I think that's what, if you really are aiming high, that's what you want to do. You don't just want to go through the motions and people say, oh yeah, I really like the kills. I get bored with people who think about horror films in terms of, how many kills did it have? Oh, not that many. I don't know if I want to see it. That's not why I go to see movies.
I'm the same way, or it needs gore. And they're like, well, it didn't have enough gore, you know, or they cut away from the gore, because a lot of times in my mind, what you can picture in your own mind is worse than what you're going to see. So it'll have some, but it'll cut away and leave it to your imagination.
And I think both ways can be effective. I think a lot of directors don't even think of it that way. They'll just like throw a ton of blood into something because they think that's what they're supposed to do. And as you said, there are other times where I've seen recent films where you figure they can do anything they want and they'll cut away from the gore. And for all you know, it may simply be because, oh, well, we ran short of time that day and we didn't get to shoot those shots.
Oh, or the budget. There's so many factors that are there. But it works with the edit. Or maybe they did do it, but the effects didn't work as well as they wanted.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's most likely that's the case.
Or it's just like with Jaws, where the shark didn't work well, so that's why there's so few scenes with the shark, which worked brilliantly in
right.
the movie.
So you have to, that's the thing, especially if you're shooting and you've got a crew and money's being spent, you have to do something with that time to keep people working. You know, As you probably know, I mean, we did a lot of practical effects work, say, on Spookies, and like as you said, that screws up all the time. In recent years, I've become more respectful of our effects, even though I felt like, you know, a lot of times, I mean, the first few days, and this happened on Street Trash too, just the first few days of shooting, we were screwing up effects all over the place because there hadn't been enough time to work on them and perfect them. And, you know, and especially on Spooky, some of the monsters were like literally ready like a minute before they appeared in front of the cameras. So we had to hope that things would happen as hoped for. But in the long run, I think most of the stuff did come off. And I've looked at other movies from that period that Spookies was similar to. And the fact that ultimately our original title, Twisted Souls, got changed to Spookies because of films like Ghoulies and Gremlins and Goonies and all these films from around that time. But some of those films, the other cheap monster movies of that time, I think we had better effects. I just, I looked at them and objectively speaking, I think, even though our special effects crew was incredibly young and inexperienced, I really am very happy about what they did.
And you had a diverse crew because you had a lot of people that were in different areas working on their effects at the same time. You know, so that way
they were almost all people just starting in the business, whether it was doing monsters and prosthetic stuff and puppetry, and it really You know, and a lot of the same people I brought, you know, afterwards into Street Trash to do various things that we needed done. But it's, to tell the truth, I mean, it was kind of like, I guess I was too naive then to be too, you know, to be aware of all the pitfalls that there were with things like effects and all the things that would need to be redone or rethought or whatever. But, you know, I mean, we plunged into everything sort of fearlessly. And I think that kind of thing can count for a lot, even if you don't fully have the experience.
Now, during this time in the 80s, in like late 70s, 80s, because you were working on other things too. Some of them, you know, you guys are trying to get certain things off the ground and stuff. Did you get to work with some other independent filmmakers at all, whether just in ideas or just talking with them of note? I didn't know if you got to work with any of the filmmakers in Maryland or New York or any of that stuff.
No, I mean, I knew people, you know, all around like the New York indie scene at the time. I mean, a lot of people making, you know, sleazy low budget movies of one sort or another. I never met Lloyd Kaufman, even though I hung out in his offices at the Troma building on a number of occasions. And Troma was a company that I always thought, oh, I should go to them and ask them to finance something, whatever. And my partner, Brendan's partner of mine, Tom Doran, at one time went to them and said, oh, I want to make this movie. Could you give me like $20,000 or something? And they, whatever it was, they liked it. And then they said, but we can only give you $5,000. And his response was, well, that wouldn't even pay for the film stock that would be needed to shoot it.
Yeah, you need, you know, of course, nowadays, you know, nobody needs film stock even anymore. But back then, you know, it's amazing where, you know, you think you'd be able to get a yay amount of money. And he probably went in saying a low number. And
right.
And, you know, and then he got really, I guess he should have said, I need 80,000, and he might have got like 15,000.
Not from Troma. No, not from Troma. I don't know. I don't think they had 15,000 in the building.
I'm just, you know, joking about how like whatever number you want, you always want to say, oh, if you're going to ask for like more than that. That way, if they hit you with a lower number, it might be nearer to the number you want. Where if you come in with a number you absolutely need, then it's if they give you less than that, you're already too low.
Yeah, I mean, I went for a long time, and after Spookies, I rejoined Creative Forces with Tom Doran, who was the co-director with Brendan, and we started, you know, putting together new projects again, right? Even though we felt, we didn't know how to use Spookies as a way to convince people to give us money again, because we had gotten nothing. Up until fairly recently, we got nothing but negativity about Spookies for decades, everywhere, you know. We didn't know how to overcome it, because it was difficult enough to have to go to people and say, all right, well, we made this film, but it's not the film we made, and every scene is fucked up, but it'll still show you something that we can do.
Yeah, that's hard when you're starting your sales pitch that way.
It was almost impossible. And, you know, and on so many occasions where we went to try and use it in that way, it had exactly the opposite effect. You know, no. I mean, nowadays I get people like, you know, constantly out of nowhere, just, oh, Spookies is great. It's a classic. It was never a classic until recently.
That is true. I mean, it's hard for me to put in words, because having seen the movie, I can see exactly where the seams are between the two movies.
If you're looking for them, it's not hard to spot.
It's pretty darn obvious, you know, two different visual styles, two different styles altogether. And I really, really wish that somehow that footage would have been from the original movie that you guys shot was still there. And
I have been asked a billion times. I've been asked a billion times if the footage exists somewhere. We received word that the backer, Michael Lee, had in an interview actually said, oh no, that stuff is actually just gone forever. We trashed everything. So until it turns up, that's what I have to assume has happened.
And I remember Brendan telling me there was a chance when you guys were contacted about somebody had to come pick up the footage, and the lawyer advised him, don't do it. You know, that kind of stuff.
Well, we had a very cautious lawyer. But looking back on it now, I wouldn't have cared if they sued the hell out of me. I had nothing to take at that time.
I mean,
I just think it's a sad story because it's sort of an extreme example of the kind of thing that happens to filmmakers all the time. You know, because once you're, if you're a creative person and you make the film, you write or direct or whatever, the film at some point is taken away from you, and then the powers that be that put the money out turn it into whatever they see it as being. And you may be happy with that at times, and you may be completely disgusted by it. So it's just something to be aware of. I think it's gotten better in recent years because a lot of movies that at one time would have just come out in a fashion different than whatever the director wanted now have videos that have the director's cut on them also. So you can actually see the difference.
It would have been so cool. That would have been amazing. You know, you never know. Some things do turn up in weird, obscure areas. So there is always.
I'm very into old films. I'm into film preservation. I know stuff completely unexpected that you'd think there's no possible way suddenly shows up in a basement or in somebody's closet or whatever it comes down to, and it could happen. I don't think it's happened, but it could happen.
I don't think so either. And now you've been working on a film that I think that just came out this year, or it's coming out this year, Hell of the Screaming Undead.
Okay. That came out a couple of years ago. That's probably at least 2 or 3 years old.
It had 2023 on IMDb.
I'm friendly with a filmmaker named Dustin Ferguson, who is one of these people who has been at the top of the micro-budget movement, meaning he makes nothing but micro-budget films, mostly horror, most of them, anywhere from $5,000 to $20,000 or something like that, shot quickly, whatever, and they're reasonably slick. But the thing is, I mean, he's good at marketing himself, and he's filling a niche in the market, and he's got fans, and he's got people, who are expecting his next movies. So I admire that. I mean, I wish, I don't think I'm in a position at the age that I am and with the background that I have, it wouldn't make sense for me to go out and try, running around trying to do $5,000 movies. It would not bring me what I want, but I really dig that. I mean, if we had had that opportunity back when we were looking for money for movies, back in the 70s and 80s, that's the direction myself and most filmmakers would go in. And that's what people are doing now. And it means there are like hundreds of really awful cheap movies out there, but that's fine.
Well, I think there's always every year in filmmaking, going back for long, long periods of time, especially when people were able to get their own video, own cameras at home. There are a lot of films of dubious quality that always have come out, but now it's in a sense because of internet that people can find them more readily. So it seems like
plus films that are barely, sophisticated enough to be actually called films can get a distributor and get out there.
Well, that is true. And some of them work well, and some of them don't. I mean, it's just, but again, I got to give them credit for actually getting the whole thing done, because of their low budget, the acting is usually spotty at best in a lot of those because they're not able to get a lot of professional actors that are used to doing films. Sometimes it's their first thing. It's their friend's friend. Can you bring them over? That kind of thing to help pull it so they can get the film done.
But as I said, people like Dustin, he's more in line with this. He's been doing it for years. So he actually has like a successful business model to continue doing this type of, he's trying to move up to bigger and more elaborate things. But I personally think that's great. And I sort of feel that's where the whole business has to move eventually, to the point where they're like, book publishing is barely even still in existence. But the point is with books, there was a chance you could write books about almost anything and you'd find somewhere there was a publisher willing to, interested in what you do, and somewhere there was an audience for what you did. And I think the same thing is true with films. And the thing is, I think in many ways right now, doing it with movies has a better shot simply because there's a strong fan voice, so that every time somebody makes some cheap micro budget movie, no matter what the quality of it is. There are people connected to it. There are people supporting it. It gets out there, gets word of mouth. If it's at all good, it'll get that word of mouth. If it's at all bad, it'll get that word of mouth. But either way, people will want to see it.
And being that it's so such a small budget, it doesn't take much, in theory, in order to get its money back, except for the streaming services paying a fair rate.
No, the problem getting your money back doing films like that is you usually wind up getting a distributor who will never show you what the film is bringing in, and you will never see a dime. It's unfortunately what it comes down to. Some people see a little money. Occasionally someone sees some reasonable money, but most of these people are just, they're not making money, and they're not doing it to make money.
I know. I'm personal friends with a couple of independent filmmakers that do the smaller budget ones, and they've put out really solid work, and you can see the growth of them over the 10-year period that they've each been working, where you look at their earlier stuff and you look at their current stuff, you can see market improvement, and usually everything is getting better all around. And them, just like everybody else, it's just they're doing it for the love. You know, they're doing it with, they have like another day of
a, I wish that was the only reason people made films, because the average Hollywood movie is really, it's more of a business venture than it is a creative venture. You know, they're weighing all the pros and cons of, all right, can we spend X amount of dollars and see X amount of dollars? But I think I was starting to say before, one of the changes that I think is coming and it started is that I think that Hollywood itself has to move away from doing $300,000 movies. A lot of them have failed in the past few years.
Yeah, I think you mean $300 million movies.
Oh, yeah, probably $300 million.
$300,000 movies, they'd be jumping at toes. That's
I understand, right? Well, they'd never make a movie that keeps in Hollywood these days. But I think it's an insane business, decision to spend that much money on something that is known to be an amazingly high risk. And especially at a time when the audiences are very fickle. I mean, a movie can come out one week. It may not even be especially good. For some reason, it captures the public. Boom, instant hit. Something absolutely amazing just doesn't get the right marketing and publicity. It gets maybe some bad initial reviews, and it dies. And it takes, another 10 or more years for it to get rediscovered or whatever. Plus now, I think there are so many movies coming out now, I have a hard time keeping up, because I have to figure out, because I see a lot, but I have to sort of be discerning and et cetera. And there's a lot of stuff that, I've always been puzzled by the very low budget romances and things like that. And I don't quite get the market that those serve. It's like, usually people want a romantic comedy. They want to see actors that they know, or I have nothing against that type of film. I just don't know commercially what you can really expect. And I don't know how people go out there not knowing what to expect.
Well, you and I are not the target audience for that. I think we can both suffice to say. Not. My wife is, and my daughter is too. That doesn't always have to be a named person for them. They're when they see the commercials for them, the trailers, they're usually looking at the storyline. And if they think that's a good storyline, then they're in. If it's an actor that they know and like, then they're definitely in. But if it's an actor that they don't like, there's sometimes they'll be like, I don't want to see anything with her or him in it. And it's an automatic, nope, it's gone.
Right.
You need all the types out there. I mean, I don't, but
so yeah, there, you there and are I definitely are not the type. Many, there are many films I am not the audience for.
And I know that when I'm looking at films and I'll be like, I see the trailer, I'm like, okay. And I have some friends of mine, they'll say, you're going to see that movie? It's like, no, I am not the audience for that. And they go, but you like horror films. I say, yeah, but I'm not seeing The Human Centipede. I don't care what you say.
Believe it or not, then you'll be very upset, because I have seen The Human Centipede and I like The Human Centipede. And I've seen the two sequels to The Human Centipede. And I think the intention was that to have a concept that most people would find immediately disgusting and think, oh, I don't want to see that, right? And the fact is that all three films are entirely different, dwell on different things. And especially the second one, is extremely disturbing.
Yeah, you're not selling it to me, but it's... but that's the beauty of film. And like I was saying, it's like there's certain films, but one of the things I've always used to do when I used to work for the American Red Cross, and I used to teach CPR classes at different companies 200 to 250 times a year. And for a while there, when you're waiting for everybody to show up for the class, you have to have filler. And I used to ask people, what's your favorite movie? And you get these people that, you know, some people's like, oh, I don't watch movies. This is fine. Then I'll ask them their favorite TV show or music or whatever. But on good more than one occasion, you get somebody say their favorite movie. And one of them was Suspiria. And I was like, what's that about? And he told me what it was about and why he liked it. And This is back when Netflix was doing its DVD releases. And I put it on my thing, moved it to the top of the list, got it within a couple of weeks, put it in. And I was like, whoa. I was just totally blown away by Suspiria. Uh-huh. And so movies that there a lot of times when somebody really recommends it and they describe it so well, and I know it's hitting me, everything they're describing is ticking off boxes of stuff I like, I'll go watch them. And more often than not, way more often than not, that because that person, you know, loved it. A lot of times I'll really enjoy it or love it too. And Suspiria, I was so happy that person recommended it to me like 20 some odd years ago.
Yeah. I mean, I feel that one of the inevitable problems that exists is simply that especially with something like horror, the constant repetition, the reliance on, you know, just using the same basic premise over and over again, or doing endless sequels to one property. I think it's worn down people's tastes and judgment. The last two Halloween sequels, right, directed by the same guy, I thought were just a joke. It's like, and this guy is apparently now a fairly big deal. He just directed the Exorcist sequel that is out. But the films, I guess I feel like it was something like that, instead of just doing more of the same, why would you, especially when you're ending a series, why wouldn't you just go completely crazy and do something that was so unexpected that they'd be talking about it for 10 years?
I know where you're going. And some people will say that last movie he did go totally unexpected, and the people probably will be talking about it for 10 years.
Somewhat unexpected, but it was ultimately, I guess it's the kind of thing where I see so few movies that like just blow me away in terms of like, all right, well, this is beyond anything I'm expecting. And that's always, when I'm writing something or hoping to make a film, that's always been my goal. It's like, I want to do something that is just beyond whatever people are expecting. I want this to be beyond that. You might be aware, I've written a spooky sequel that I feel is pretty much, for me at the moment at least, is fulfilling those basic obligations. I want to do something, and this is based on our late partner Tom Doran wrote a story before he passed away. I adapted it into a script. I've been getting tremendous reactions to it generally. I'm working out a few legal and business aspects of it now, and I'm looking to start raising money in a few months. I just wanted to do something that was like everything we couldn't do or wouldn't have been allowed to do in the first Spookies. Plus, I want to make a real movie that like has characters and has some kind of substance to it and has, you know, all these, you know, boxes checked off as to what a movie really should be. I want to make the movie I want to see. And if we can do the script I've got, I think we can get near that at least. It's the kind of thing where I literally want the fans to be in shock at how much of an improvement this is over the original film.
I'll be excited to see it because I want to see what the vision that you guys could bring, at least one of the original team, you know, but actually in a sense, two of them, because you're taking the story that Tom wrote and you adapted it and can bring to the screen. And of course, there'll be no Michael Lee involvement. So then we'll be able to have this, hopefully, this.
Oh, I mean, my position at this point is I would do almost anything I would walk off a new film if that kind of situation repeated itself. There's no reason for it to. You know, I mean, at that time, we were dealing with someone who just couldn't hear what we were trying to say, was convinced we were completely larcenous and trying to screw him over and fuck him and take his money. And only because I think that's how he lived his life. I want to do the same thing we wanted to do back then. I want to make a film that would blow people away.
I'm hoping.
I am too, you know. I mean, I'm making connections. I've gotten a lot of response from various people that I want to work with on this. I see it as a necessary thing. It's also for me, it's like, you know, because Tom passed away fairly young, and I really want, you know, this is the last thing we collaborated on together. And, you know, we were just determined to still make films, no matter how many times we got rejected or projects started to go and then didn't happen. And, you know, because I truly respected him. He was like, he remained intensely creative, very original. You know, we worked very well together. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure that if I were the one who were no longer here, he would be doing the same thing now, you know, knowing how much it would have meant to me. And I see, you know, we'll see how it goes. At the moment, I have, a script. I have a certain rough budgetary figure. And I've been advised on various sides to you know, budget it higher or to budget it lower. And again, it's a matter of like, who do you come in contact with that might be capable of financing it, and what are they going to think? You know, and I'm so, unfortunately, I spent way too much time with people like Michael Lee, who would, no matter what you said to him, would want things to be cheaper. You know, it's like, and I forget if Brendan told this story when you interviewed him, but it's like when we came to him and we did many versions of a budget until he was satisfied with what was what. And I remember him, you know, we got to the point where, you know, we thought we had our first really solid version of the budget. We bring it in and he's looked at it, and then we go to meet with him, and he says, well, we all know, and we went crazy trying to keep it as low as we could with concern every step of the way as to whether we could really pull it off for this amount of money. And his first response is, well, we all know this movie should cost about half of what you have down here. You know, he felt we were still trying to cheat him and bullshit him about the cost of the movie.
Some people just expect certain things because, like you said, that's the way they treat other people. So it's just that they're expecting to be treated the same way.
It's true, but it's like, I think the thing is, we just kept trying to drive home to him, look, we're here, this is our motivation. The only reason we're doing this is to make the best film that we can make. That's all we want to do. And we would love to see you make as much money as you could make. It doesn't have to get more complicated than that, but he turned it into something else.
Which is sad. When that happened. For people that want to follow to see how it's going for you with Spookies 2 or other projects you're involved, where can they follow to keep an eye?
The best place to find me is I do most of my social media on Facebook under my own name, Frank Farrell, F-A-R-E-L. I have a pretty active page. I post stuff every day, more or less. I have been posting bits and pieces of information about the new Spookies potentials. With that, I've made people aware that it's sort of in the works. Until I get to a point where, I mean, we're finalizing business aspects of it, got to get the presentation where we want it. And then when I go out looking for financing, I will make that known. And if nobody on the planet Earth will finance it, I'll make that known.
Well, hopefully somebody on the planet Earth, hopefully at least.
I don't see why they wouldn't at this point, you know, beyond which I think the script is damn good. I think they're going to be, you know, I think I wrote a script that I felt with maybe a few tweaks to make it less gory or something could be easily be like a family film. It's, it's in some ways like a Gremlins or something where there's a very definite comedic aspect of it. But at the same time, it's like it's got a lot of good characters and relationships, and I think there's something there. I think audiences don't always get that nowadays. I think most genre films, even the expensive ones, just go through a lot of the motions, and they really don't feel like they're even obligated to go beyond that.
Oh, I agree with you. A lot of horror genre films, it, you can tell they put people in there, they hit the certain tropes of types of people they're expected to have, and it's just for a body count. They're going to be, you don't care about them. But like you said, there are some people out there that love to see the kills and be creative and that kind of stuff, and that's really all they care about. And they don't, and so they'll be satisfied. But for those of us that actually get more out of a horror film when you care about the people that are being tormented or possibly killed.
I don't think you even have to so much quote care about them. I think you have to find them interesting. You have to be engaged by them. So even if there's a character that you hate, that you don't like the character, you like what the character is doing. You like the entertainment value of this, and you're engaged, right? And you're going to be interested in whatever happens with that character. So and this has been true. I started to have issues with horror movies back in the late 80s at the start of the video revolution, at about the time Spookies came out, meaning that's when everything started to very much, budgets got lower. Companies like Charlie Band's company and things like that just kept churning out low budget little monsters and creatures and all this sort of stuff. And they got very much into, and this is what's endured to this day that I find frustrating, is so much stuff is intentional schlock or intentional schlock parody, and to the point now where people are doing intentional schlock parody of intentional schlock parody of intentional schlock parody. And it's, really, how much more can you do with this? It's like, unless you're really a good writer and you're talented and you can do something that's exceptional, a lot of it just is incredibly repetitious at this point. And it's so funny because all this kind of style of stuff, which at one time was really the audience that responded to this was, people like you and myself, film buffs, and people who liked bizarre, cheap movies, and et cetera. But that's become sort of the mental state of a lot of these movies now for a mainstream audience, which means I don't think they're going at it sincerely. In a lot of cases, it's people who love that kind of movie. And in a lot of cases, it's people who just want to make a movie thinking that's what they should do. I just like to see more original thinking. I want concepts that make me go, I'd like to see that, as opposed to like, all right, well, here's another version of this movie that you've seen since you were born.
And you bring back
Go ahead.
And then you bring back somebody from an older version of the movie just so you can say for a cameo or extended cameo, and you can say, oh, but that movie was great because it brought that person back. And I was like, they just did that to sell tickets.
I've actually said this to a lot of contemporary horror fans where I'm saying, like, you got to raise your standards, man. You don't deserve this crap, and you shouldn't keep accepting it. It's like the last Texas Chainsaw sequel was so weak and so completely oblivious to the whole legacy that they were making another sequel to. It's like I don't understand how blind they can be to the fact, all right, this movie's been popular for decades, or the series has been popular for decades, despite the fact that since the first couple of movies, almost all of them were bad, right? But the audience is at a stage where they expect these things to be bad. If they get a few cheap thrills or laughs out of something, then they'll say it's great. You get people who I don't know what company wound up with the rights to the Texas Chainsaw franchise that did that last movie, but that seemed like a film that was literally made on the ride to the location they wrote it, and some guy in the car said, oh, I saw those movies, I'll tell you about them, and then when they got out they started making the movie.
You wonder sometimes what I don't know what's going through their heads. I saw the trailer for that movie. I never saw it, the full version. I think I got everything I needed from the trailer. And I had friends of mine that I trust their opinions, and they saw the movie and pretty much were saying the same thing. You're just doing it. They're like, don't see it, Steve. Don't see it.
It does nothing in a creative way. It ignores everything that the, you know, was established in any previous film. It literally came off to me like somebody doing a bad ripoff of those movies.
Well, since this episode is going to be coming out in October, so later this month, recommend a movie that somebody might want to watch that spin out that's out there for them to go find for the Halloween season. You can pick one, or, you know, pick a couple that you think that, hey, you go see this one.
Oh gosh, for the Halloween season, that's tough. Pick one
that's an obvious one, and pick maybe a different one that people don't know as much.
God, this is always a tough question for me. Like when people ask me, what are your favorite movies? And then I think, do we have time for 12,000 movies? Because I tend to like a lot of stuff, and I know there are people that have favorite movies and they get fixated on them and they watch them again and again. And I used to do that myself all the time, but then like all the other movies ever made seem to have become available since then. So I'm sort of forced to go beyond that.
I feel it. I'm the same way, because there are a few films which I'll watch every year or two. I'm not talking Halloween films. I'm just talking in general. But when it gets to Halloween, people be like, I always watch this and this and this. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm watching this and that and that. And usually it's ones I haven't seen or hadn't seen in a long time. Just because I like you, there's so many movies, I just want to see other things.
Right, exactly. If you wanted me to recommend, quote, a Halloween movie, I'd probably recommend something obscure or really old, mostly because... I recommend a film called The Black Pit of Dr. M. Are you familiar with this film?
I haven't seen it, but I know the title.
Okay, it's a Mexican film. It's from 1959. Now, Mexican horror movies of the 50s and 60s are like the best black and white atmosphere in any movies just about prior to the Universal horror movies. Or pardon me, since the Universal horror movies of the 30s and 40s. So there's this great atmosphere. There's a lot of like cheesiness and ridiculousness, but The Black Pit of Dr. M, I think, is one of the best horror films ever made. It's not really very well known for some reason. It's finally out on a Blu-ray not too long ago, but it's got some of the best photography, atmosphere. It's full of bizarre, sleazy moments. Is a film. And this is a film I used to watch on Chiller Theater in New York City as a kid. And it freaked me out the first time I saw it. And I still think it's pretty disturbing. So I highly recommend it. The original title was called Mysteries of the Inner Tomb.
Mysteries of the Inner Tomb. But the black Pit of Dr. M. I'm going to make sure I watch it for this October. So I'm definitely going to see it. And hopefully some listeners will see it too, you know, because, you know, why not?
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I think everyone should see everything, but it's the kind of film that to me, that film is worth more than, like, you know, 99% of what I see, you know, being made in the past decade. I don't think people go into filmmaking for the most part with the same kind of artistic intent, and I think the movies that do sort of stand out and it shows up on screen. And I know saying things, you know, talking about art and art being artistic sounds maybe pretentious or something, but I think that's ultimately what everybody wants. You want something that rises above just, you know, the standard or the easy to do.
Well, I think so. And everybody has a different frame of mind or different point, a different time when they're watching a film. Sometimes you're in a state of mind where you just want that quick, easy, eye candy, relaxing.
It's like food or, you know, it's like, you know, you go up and you say, and they say, all right, well, what do you want? And you may want, you know, almost anything, or you may want the same thing you always have because that's what you always have. You know, I do wish a lot of these people, I mean, 80s horror is now hotter than it ever has been. And I don't know what's going to replace that, because I don't know if in 10 years people are going to be raving about 90s horror in the same way. Because most of what went on in the 90s was sort of a continuation of what went on in the 80s, but not as well, not as good.
Yeah, I agree with you there. We'll see. We'll find out as time goes by. You know, what is eventually everything right. has a cycle and it moves through and it goes to a different thing. Maybe it'll be a reboot back to the 70s where it goes back to the more downer ones with realistic type movie making as there was.
Yeah, I mean, I'd 70s. Be fine with that. I tend to like, almost everything. I just, as I said, I think things started to lose some of their gravity when the video revolution happened in the mid to late 80s. It just, it gave way to people making less effort than ever before in terms of the filmmaking.
But I'm going to
thank you. Fans will have me excoriated for that.
But I want to thank you for taking time to talk with me about the movies that you did, filmmaking in general, and that kind of stuff. I had a fun time.
I had a wonderful time talking. I always like having conversations like this. And this is one of the things I try to impress on people who are fans of mine, because occasionally I'll have somebody talk to me or meet me or I'll respond to their message online and they'll be like, oh my God, I can't believe you're talking to me. And it's like, calm down. I'm just a guy. I'm just a geek like you. Let's just talk about movies.
And that's the fun part. And when you get to meet people, whether it's different conventions or just happenstance, they're filmmakers. Usually you have something there you can talk to them about, because most filmmakers love film. And you don't always have to talk to them about their films. You can start talking about other films they enjoy. And then the next thing you know, you're having a great conversation.
Well, the thing is, no matter what the particular works that you're really interested in art, there's an enthusiasm and a passion. And most people don't have any kind of an enthusiasm or real passion in their lives. They may have some interest, whatever, but they don't have something that really brightens their lives in certain ways that they feel is special to them. As I sort of said earlier, I think the horror and sci-fi fans, those are the film fans that have made the difference. I think they've helped keep the movie business alive over the decades. They're always at the forefront of any big audience phenomena, in recent years especially.
Yeah. Well, Frank, I want to thank you again for joining me on this Sunday.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Thanks again, Frank, for allowing me to do it. Also, I want to let listeners know that if you want to leave us feedback, you can send it to emails to us at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com. or leave us a message on our Facebook page. Just want to remind listeners that another thing we do on Diecast Movie Podcast is we have a sub-series which is dedicated to movies from Hammer Films, and it's called Hammerama, which Alistair Hughes and I do. Give everybody a taste of what that's like. We're going to play the promo to end the episode. So hope everybody has a good day, and as always, thank you for listening.
I'm Al. From New Zealand.
And I'm Stephen from Maryland, USA.
We are Hammerama. Welcome to our new podcast. Enter freely.
And of your own will.
Part of the multi-award nominated diecast movie podcast, Hammerama is a wide look at the world of Hammer horror from either side of the globe.
Each month, we will throw a die to decide which category from the film vault of Hammer we are going to discuss. The Dracula, Frankenstein, or Mummy Cycles, science fiction, prehistory, or the experimental 1970s.
We will cast our international eyes across then and now reviews of the movie,
its place in the Hammerverse,
our encounters with the stars,
a film poster critique,
and unusual associated merchandise.
So join us for our bite-sized discussion of Hammer's gory glories, stitched together from both ends of the earth.
Hammerama is a proud part of the Diecast Movie Podcast.